moving on. And it didn't go down very well. But she just replied with the retort, if my nose is like the Tower of Lebanon, then what's your nose like, Mark? And I had no comeback to that. Guys, there's Bibles there and outlines if you want to feel free to grab them as you come in. We're just getting underway. We're looking at Song of Songs, chapter 1. Now, in the kind of lead-up to thinking about this book and this chapter, I did a bit of a survey. So I wanted to ask people, what associations do they have between, when they think of the Bible and sex, and particularly what the Bible teaches about sex? And we gave people an option of 10 words to choose from. I picked 5 positive words and 5 negative words. And you can see them up on the screen there. Words like pleasure, sin, repression, gift, virtue, and so on. And I first put this survey on the Atheist Society Facebook page, and here's how they responded. 19 people most associate the Bible teaching on sex with repression, 8 with patriarchy, 3 with hypocrisy, 2 with intolerance, 1 with sin, 1 with pleasure, 1 with beauty. When we added in other people we spoke to around campus, so not just the atheists, it balanced out a little bit, but the top 5 were still my 5 negative words. Repression, patriarchy, intolerance, hypocrisy, sin. When people think about Christianity and sex, overwhelmingly, they have negative associations in their mind. Now, why is that? Well, in part, it's because over 2,000 years, the church's record has been mixed at best. There have been some positive stories. So, for example, sociologist Rodney Stark suggests that in the ancient world, one of the things that contributed to Christianity growing in the first few centuries was its view on sex and on the treatment of women in particular. On the other hand, there's been spectacular and recurring failures, and failures of two kinds. First, there's been failures of practice. Emblazoned on the front pages of newspapers, paraded on all current affairs TV programs, is the failure of Christians, and particularly Christian leaders, when it comes to practice in the area of sexuality. And the reason this failure has become so public is because Christians and churches have failed to keep their own house clean. When leaders have sinned and done what's deplorable, rather than their sin being brought to light and condemned, it's been covered up. There's a history of scandal and hypocrisy. And people devour this. They devour reports of Christians falling, Christian leaders falling in this area, like they read best-selling novels. So my Gmail inbox has started being spammed with Yahoo 7 news updates. I'm not quite sure how. But anyway, I get these Yahoo 7 news updates. And last week included headlines like this: gun sales soar in the wake of massacre. Think about the Massacre of the Batman movie. A woman trapped between 400-ton landslide. That sounds interesting. I didn't read it, though. Sewage flows through village, about athletes abandoning the Olympic village because of a sewage problem. Hottest female stars for 2012. That is Yahoo's list of scorching hot female bodies for 2012. But what stunned me most was that the most read news item was this one: victim comes forward over priest's sex abuse. It wasn't the news item that had the biggest picture. It wasn't the one that had the largest profile in the email. But that was the one that attracted the most interest. Even when in it offered what I assume could be semi-pornographic images of the scorching hot female bodies, what did people prefer to look at? They preferred to read about a priest sex abuse scandal. There have been desperate failures in practice that have justifiably attracted widespread attention. There have also been failures in doctrine. Earlier this week there was an editorial piece in the ABC News website, and it asked the question, is there a future for Christianity? By Ross Douthat, a New York Times columnist. Is there a future for Christianity? And among other things, he discussed Christians' view of morality, and in particular of sex. And I don't agree with everything he says, but some of the things he said I thought are quite right on the mark. Take this. He says, come on the screen. Thanks, Tim. No aspect of Christian faith is less appealing to contemporary sensibilities than the faith's long list of thou shalt nots. And no prohibition attracts more exasperation and contempt than the Christian view of chastity and sex. So he says, one of the things that people hate about Christianity is that it just seems to be about thou shalt not, especially in the area of sex. And he goes on to talk a bit about heterosexuality and homosexuality, and particularly out the bad press Christianity has when it comes to homosexuality. And he says this, it's worth emphasising that one reason the Christian insistence on chastity for homosexuals seems particularly cruel and unreasonable is that the Christian churches no longer successfully hold up heterosexual chastity as a clearly defined, successfully lived out ideal. Heterosexual chastity, that doesn't mean perpetual abstinence and virginity. It means chaste sexuality between men and women. Heterosexual sex within marriage. And saying churches no longer hold this up as a clearly defined, successfully lived out ideal. See, Christians have had a range of responses to sexual promiscuity down through the years, and you've got to admit it's rampant in our society, as it was in the ancient world, sexual promiscuity, anything goes. But the response that's attracted the most attention and which has captured the imagination of the majority of the world's population is that sex is seen as dirty and unclean and sinful. When people think Christianity and sex, that's what they think. In fact, singleness and virginity have been held up as the ideal, more holy path. Epitomised in a celibate priesthood, proclaimed by male Christian theologians and often accompanied by a fear of sex, which perhaps is even a fear of women on the part of those male theologians. For 2,000 years, the loudest message has been sex is bad and the most holy people avoid it altogether. It's not surprising then that the main interpretation of the Song of Songs down through the century has been purely allegorical. That is, Christians have generally read this book as a story of Christ and his relationship with the church, or of God and about God and Israel, or about the longings of the human soul for the word of God, some form of allegory. But whatever we do, we shouldn't take it as love poems about a human relationship. Friends, let me suggest that's a tragic loss. Confronted with a world that is confused and haywire and disordered when it comes to sex, what have Christians done? We have failed to proclaim a positive alternative. And we've failed to live a positive alternative. And one of the best resources for proclaiming the truth, the Song of Songs, we've hidden away behind this unconvincing theory that it's just an allegory about Christ and the church. There are three types of people who need to hear the message of this book today. On the one hand, there are those amongst us who are just caught up with, embroiled in this sex-saturated, anything-goes approach of our society. A society that worships sex like a god. The more sex, better sex, uninhibited sex, free sex. And for those people, they suspect that the Bible has nothing to say but thou shalt not. That's one group of people that needs this message today. Secondly, there are many of us who are Christian for whom sex has become an awkward, possibly sinful, no-go zone. Better to be avoided, not thought about. And thirdly, there are other people who have been deeply hurt by sex. And when I say deeply hurt by sex, of course I mean deeply hurt by people, probably men, who have used sex as an instrument of abuse. It is terrible and tragic. Maybe I'm speaking to some people here. And it has left you with deep, deep wounds. Well, this book has something to say to each of those groups. So let's have a look at it together. Song of Songs, chapter 1, verse 1. Solomon's Song of Songs. This gives us the title of the book. Now, Song of Songs, that's a superlative. It's like saying the very best of songs. Holy of Holies in the Bible is the most holy place. Or King of Kings, or Lord of Lords, or Vanity of Vanities. Song of Songs, the finest song, the best song. Now, that's a big claim. Because there are lots of songs in the Bible, aren't there? How can this be the best song? In fact, doesn't it strike you as almost a blasphemous claim? How could this song be better than the Psalms? The Song of Songs, the finest song. Right at the outset, we have a very strong statement that repression of sexuality is not a biblical position. Here's a book about sex, which finds its place in the scriptures, and what's more, which is called the finest song. And when we look at verse 1, we also see that it introduces the book as one song, Solomon's Song of Songs. It isn't an anthology of love poems. It isn't just a collection of thematically linked but otherwise unrelated poems. It's one song, the Song of Songs, which encourages us to look for an overall message throughout the book, perhaps even a story. And thirdly, we see that it is Solomon's Song of Songs. Now, in what way is this song Solomon's? Well, there's three options. Option one, it's by Solomon. He's the author. It's Solomon's Song of Songs because he wrote it. Option two, it's for Solomon. It's dedicated to him. Option three, it is about Solomon. Now, any of those is a valid understanding of the Hebrew construction underlying this word, this phrase. It could be by Solomon, it could be for Solomon, it could be about Solomon. Which is it? Well, to put my cards on the table right up front, I think it's the third. I think it is about Solomon in some way. And I think that because of the way Solomon is portrayed in this book. I don't think this is how Solomon would portray himself. And I don't think this is how someone who is dedicating a book to Solomon would portray him. So how is it about Solomon? Well, again, there's a few ways it could be about Solomon. Option one, he could be the male lover. He's the main character, the male lover in this story. Option two, although it's not directly about him, he could be like the ideal. So it's about two other people, but he's sort of the ideal lover that the man is portrayed as. Or option three, he is not the main character, nor the ideal, but he is the foil. He is the contrast to the story that unfolds here. And I want to suggest to you that I think that is how the Song of Songs is intended, us to understand the place of Solomon. Click forward with me to chapter 8, verse 11. Chapter 8, verse 11. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Hamon. He let out his vineyard to tenants. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver. But my own vineyard is mine to give. The 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon, and 200 are for those who tend its fruit. So in these verses, right at the end of the book, we have this contrast, and it's a contrast between two vineyards. On the one hand, Solomon's vineyard, and on the other hand, the woman's vineyard. The vineyard, now we see this back in, keep your finger in chapter 8, because we'll be looking there, but chapter 1, verse 6, we see the vineyard there is a symbol of the woman's body, and perhaps in particular, her sexuality. Chapter 1, verse 6, halfway through the verse, my mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I've neglected. See, the woman's brothers or half-brothers, her mother's sons, had forced her to do this hard outdoor work, caring of the vineyards, and as a result, she had neglected her own vineyard, neglected care of her own body. So what do we see back in chapter 8? Well, we see that there are this contrast between Solomon's vineyard and the woman's vineyard. What do we see about Solomon's vineyard? Well, Solomon owned a vineyard. He had a vineyard. We're told it's in Baal Haman. Those words in Hebrew mean something like master of wealth or master of riches, which is certainly what Solomon was. And what was Solomon's vineyard? The woman or women he owned, well, we know from elsewhere in the Bible, there were 1,000 of them, 700 wives, 300 concubines, a harem. Women he owned, so many women that he had to hire people to look after his vineyard. But what does the woman say? My vineyard is my own. My own vineyard is mine to give. Solomon, you can keep your vineyard, but my body is not owned by you or by anyone else. I freely and exclusively give it to the one man I love. See, the Song of Songs compares two different types of male-female relationships. I'm going to borrow some words here from a commentator, Ian Proven. The first type of male-female relationship is that in which a man and woman enter freely into love and sexual intimacy, in which they bind themselves together in lasting commitment to one another, and in which they give themselves to each other. They give themselves physically and emotionally in joyful abandonment that knows no reservation or shame. In the second type of male-female relationship, the male is in the dominant and powerful position over the female. She does not enter the relationship by choice. She is merely a pawn in a male game concerning legal contracts, money, and the collection of objects of pleasure. And the Song of Songs commends one type of male-female relationship against the alternatives. It's a critique of this Solomon, male power, women objects of pleasure way of relating. And that critique emerges as we see the story or even the plot of the Song of Songs unfold. So we see the story introduced in verses 2 to 6. Look at these for me. I'll just start off reading a couple of verses. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. Now what we see sort of straight away as we read this book is that we're dealing here with poetry. And what's more, it's poetry that kind of speaks from the emotions and speaks to the emotions. It deals with subjective impressions and feelings of the characters involved. So consider that statement, your love is more delightful than wine. It's not really an empirically quantifiable statement, is it? There's not an objective measure by which you can compare a man's love and wine and say, well, on these certain standards, love exceeds wine. It's a proclamation of the woman's emotions. This is how she feels. And what's more, this poetry, not only is it emotional in nature, but it uses lots of imagery, and much of the imagery we're unfamiliar with. So, for example, verse 5, dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem. Dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Now, we don't really know what those things are. They're unfamiliar to us. But it conjures up an image of sort of dark fabric, curtains and tents. And in the same way, this woman's skin was dark. So we've got to kind of work to understand the imagery that's used. Another thing we notice as we read through it is that we hear different voices speak. Now, most Bible translations indicate this somehow. So, for example, the 1984 NIV translation, which is what I'm working from at the moment, puts in these little headings, beloved, friends, lover, and so on. There are these different voices. And it's easy to discern this. Anyone reading this book is going to recognise there are different voices speaking. But just so you know, those headings, like lover and beloved and so on, they're not actually part of the text of the Bible. They've been inserted by the editors of the Bible trying to understand who's speaking at different times. And I think they're mostly right, but occasionally I take a different view on the odd verse here or there. Now, the reason mostly we can be very confident is because in Hebrew, unlike in English, a lot more words indicate gender, like the gender of the one, particularly pronouns. So, for example, when we use pronouns, we differentiate between he and she. If you're talking about a person, you don't just say it. You'll say, you know, him or her, or he or she. In Hebrew, you also do that not only for third person, he, she type stuff. You also do that when you use second person, so you. There's a male you and a female you. And that enables us to tell for a lot of the verses who's speaking. Is it the man speaking to the woman, or is it the woman speaking to the man? That said, so the headings are helpful. That said, I'm not sure the 1984 NIV headings are necessarily the best ones, because it uses the words beloved and lover. And if you think about that, that places the man in the kind of active initiating role and the woman in this passive receiving role. And yet you read the Song of Songs and you see that both characters initiate. Both characters are fully involved in kind of seeking and initiating and stimulating this relationship. So I think we're better to go with something fairly neutral like she and he, or man and woman, or, you know, woman and man, or perhaps to be specifically Shulamite and shepherd, but, you know, something like that. Now, the 2011 NIV has gone that way, and it just has she and he, which is a good change. Well, so there are two main characters, a man and a woman. There are also lots of minor characters, or a number of minor characters, like, for example, the daughters of Jerusalem, who are mentioned in verse 5. Now, how does the song start? Well, it starts with the woman pining for her lover. Verse 2 there that we read out, it's sensual. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. And as the song progresses, like, all the senses are involved. The lovers see one another and hear one another and touch and smell and taste one another. In verse 3, the sensual overload continues. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. Even the sound of her man's name is like perfume to her senses. And this woman believes, she's so captivated with the man she loves that she believes, whether rightly or wrongly, that her man is universally admired by all women. He's so magnificent that there's competition for his affection. No wonder the maidens love you. It goes on in verse 4, take me away with you. Let us hurry. She's pining for her lover. There's this urgency. Let's hurry. She longs to be reunited with her man. Now, why the urgency? What's going on here? What is preventing their union? Well, at this point, we're not helped, I think, by the 1984 NIV translation. The NIV translates the second half of verse 4 in this way. Let the king bring me into his chambers. Let the king bring me into his chambers. Now, does anyone here have a different Bible, a different translation? Andy, Mim, what have you got, Andy?
The king has brought me into his chambers.
What version is that?
New King James.
New King James. The king has brought me into his chambers. What have you got, Mim?
Oh, that the king would bring me
into. So that's kind of similar to the NIV. But there's a difference between. So it's translation kind of split on this. But the King James, which Andy read for us, or ESV, which will come on the screen, says, draw me after you, let us run, the king has brought me into his chambers. Now, that's actually what the Hebrew text says. It's just that because people have assumed that the lover is Solomon, that they translate it a different way. They think maybe there's been a textual transmission error or something. But it doesn't say, let the king bring me into his chambers. It says, the king has brought me into his chambers, which expresses a very different idea. So let me read the verse again. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. The king has brought me into his chambers. What's happened here? Well, the woman pines for her lover, but she finds that she has been co-opted into the king's harem. Almost certainly, she had no say in the matter. She's been brought into the king's harem of 1,000 women. And here she finds herself surrounded by other maidens. Rightly or wrongly, she imagines these other women adoring her man, perhaps as she tells stories about him. And we see more on her relationship with these other women in verses 5 and 6. Dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem. Dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I'm dark, because I'm darkened by the sun. See, she's different to these other women. Her skin is dark. But it's not an ethnic difference in this case. Why is her skin dark? She's been darkened by the sun. It's that hard labour that her mother's sons, her brothers or half-brothers, put her to. But right out at the outset, we see in some ways she's different. She doesn't conform to female society's prescriptions of what a woman should look like. She's different. And yet she's confident. Dark I am, yet lovely. She's comfortable with who she is. She's confident with her beauty. She's not ashamed. She's not hiding it. She's not denying it. Now, how can she be so confident? Well, I suspect it's because of the lavish praise that is given her by her lover. The kind of words that fill the chapters that follow. Now, what follows in the rest of the book is this kind of this sequence of vignettes, little cameos, little stories. Some of them are clearly dreams. We'll see that next week. Some of them are clearly cases she's dreaming about a situation with her man. Some of them are probably imagination or fantasies. Some of them may be describing actual events. I don't know that it's always possible to decide with certainty which case applies. But we get this collection of vignettes, and the most common kind of flow of each of these little stories, these little cameos, the most common plot is that they begin with the lovers apart, pining, wooing, beckoning to one another. And then perhaps there's some obstacle they need to overcome, and they conclude with the lovers together. And often that climax is accompanied with a profound statement about love, perhaps one of the recurring themes of the book. That said, there's much variation in them, and not every vignette ends happily. But we see there's also an overall movement in the book. So I think the book as a whole has this overall movement from chapter 1 to chapter 8, and we have these individual cameos which each have a movement, but it's not necessarily, you can't necessarily add one to the next and see a definite kind of progression onwards, if you get what I mean. A step-by-step narrative. Anyway, let's get into it. Well, what I want to do, the remainder of the talk, I just want to look at the first three vignettes to give you a feel of this book as we get into it together. The first one I've called Seeking the Shepherd, from verse 7 to 11. Verse 7. Tell me, you whom I love, where you graze your flock, and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? See, the woman is seeking the one she loves, a shepherd it seems, and she wants to find him during his midday siesta, when he rests the flock in the middle of the day. There's a hint of danger. She speaks of the need perhaps to veil herself in the presence of the other shepherds. This could be a disguise, perhaps even disguise as a prostitute, because to be out in the open may put her in some danger. Or perhaps it's because their relationship is clandestine, and whatever's going on, there's some kind of danger. And then in verse 8, we hear the man speaking. It could be the friends, but I think it's probably the man. If you do not know, most beautiful of women, follow the tracks of the sheep and graze your young goats by the tents of the shepherds. So we hear the man's reply here. I think it's a bit playful. It's inviting the woman on a search rather than giving an explicit answer. He wants her to come seeking for him. And verse 9 to 11, the vignette closes with the shepherd praising the girl. Verse 9. I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your necks are with strings of jewels. We will make your earrings of gold studded with silver. Verse 9, now what's going on there? I liken you to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. I don't know, women, if you'd consider it a compliment to be told you're like a horse. But I think the image here is Pharaoh's chariots were all pulled by stallions, male horses. And what would happen if you took a mare, a female horse, and strapped that in to the chariots of Pharaoh? Well, there'd be mayhem, as all the stallions started baying and competing for her attention. This is how the man, the shepherd, sees his beloved woman. And just as the woman saw the man as universally adored by all the maidens, so the shepherd is so captivated by his love that he sees her as driving other men to distraction. Now, where this woman in verse 7 contemplated veiling and concealing herself, her shepherd praises her beauty and resolves to add to it in verses 10 and 11, adorning her with jewelry. Well, there's our first vignette. Our second vignette I've called Love Goes Wild. Love Goes Wild. Here we see something of the power of love. And again it takes us back indoors for its kind of starting scene. And many of the individual, actually, vignettes and cameos follow that kind of pattern, starting indoors and moving to the outdoors. And I'll talk more about that a little bit later on. But starting off, verse 12. While the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. See, the king here, he's still in the picture, but the woman's mind is elsewhere. Now that expression there, while the king was at his table, it's a bit hard knowing how to translate that. The at his table word means something like in his surroundings. It's describing something that kind of surrounds something. And so if it's at a table, what I'm picturing is a circular table. Some translations suggest it's a couch, like a circular couch or something. It could also mean something like that while the king was round about himself, while the king was in his environment, while the king was in his place occupied with his business, my perfume spread its fragrance. The woman's mind and imagination wanders elsewhere, alluring her lover with the fragrance of her perfume. And then in the following verses we have this series of portraits which show us how the lovers see each other. They're caught up in admiration and delight. Look at verse 13. My lover is to me a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts. That's an image of nearness, of intimacy, even of secrecy. A sachet of myrrh, a little pouch of perfume. The word there, resting, usually means spending the night between my breasts. Verse 14, another image. My lover is to me a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of En-Gedi. This is an image of fertility and natural beauty. En-Gedi was a well-watered oasis west of the Desert Sea. You get a picture of it up on the screen so you can see something of its beauty. Thanks, Mim. There you go, there's part of the oasis. Visit it today. Here's an image of natural beauty. And fertility and life in the midst of a wilderness. Flowers in the oasis. Thanks, Mim. And this lavish praise continues in verse 15, although here it's the man speaking. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Verse 16. How handsome you are, my lover. Oh, how charming. Our bed is verdant. The word verdant means something like luxurious with foliage. The bed it's talking about here is a bed of leaves and plants and flowers. And then verse 17, which could still be the man speaking, although perhaps the woman's beam, could go either way. The beams of our house are cedars. Our rafters are firs. What does that mean? Well, I think that means, where's their meeting place? It's outdoors. It's not saying they're meeting in a house made of cedars, it's saying they're meeting in a forest. Their bed is foliage, and their beams of their house and their rafters, they're surrounded by the trunks and the branches of trees. And the praise continues. Verse 1, the woman speaking, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Again, we see this woman somewhat confident of her beauty, although perhaps here she sees herself only as one flower among many flowers, one lily among many lilies covering the valleys. But here's what her man says, like a lily among thorns, 2 verse 2, like a lily among thorns is my darling among the maidens. In his eyes, she is the only one. And likewise, in her eyes, he is the only one. Verse 3, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. She describes him as an apple tree, or perhaps an apricot tree, not sure the precise fruit, but some tree that's both tasty and fragrant and which provides shelter. We see this tree, she sees her man as a source of two things. On the one hand, a source of shelter. She delights to sit in his shade. And secondly, a source of sustenance. His fruit is sweet to my taste. And verses 4 to 6 move on to their actual lovemaking. Verse 4, he's taken me to the banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. A banquet hall literally is house of wine. Again, we're not necessarily talking indoors here. It could be a vineyard. But the idea it's conjuring up is that love is intoxicating, like going to a banquet, drinking wine in abundance. And so the woman says, she's just sort of swept up. She's overwhelmed with his love. Verse 5, strengthen me with raisins. Refresh me with apples, for I am faint with love. It's so overpowering. So overwhelming. But what she wants isn't removal from the situation, but more of the same. Raisins, or perhaps raisin cake, may have kind of aphrodisiac fertility associations, but certainly when you get to refresh me with apples, she's asking for the very fruit from his tree. She's overwhelmed by his love, but she says, give me more. Verse 6, his left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. And then in verse 7, she gives a charge to the other women. Verse 7, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles by the does of the field. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Now this is a kind of refrain in this book. It comes up 3 times at various high points in the book. Why does it come up at this point? Why say right here, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires? Because love, as we've just seen in these verses, is so powerful, it's so intoxicating, it's so overwhelming, it's not something to be treated flippantly or like a toy. There is a right way for love to find expression. It's not to be forced before the proper time. There's so much pressure on young people these days to arouse and awaken love as quickly as possible and as often as possible. And yet that pressure fails to appreciate what sexual love is, its true value, its magnificent beauty and its intoxicating power. The third vignette we have from verse 8 to 17, chapter 2, verse 8 to 17, I've called the gazelle and the foxes. The gazelle and the foxes. And again, this vignette starts with the woman indoors and other young women as her companions. But this time, rather than the woman leaving in search of her man, he comes to her and tries to draw her out. Verse 8. Chapter 2, verse 8. Listen, this is the woman speaking. Listen, my lover. Look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. He approaches like a gazelle on the mountains, graceful, beautiful, and also eager, bounding over the hills towards his cherished girl. But she's indoors. And so he stands there at the windows, at the lattice, beckoning to her. Verse 10, my lover spoke and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. See, the winter is past, the rains are over and gone, flowers appear on the earth, the season of singing has come, the cooing of doves is heard in our land. The fig tree forms its early fruit, the blossoming vines spread their fragrance. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. Verse 14, we see how he sees his lover as a dove in the cleft of the rock, hiding away. He longs to see her face. He longs to hear her voice. And then in verse 15, I think verse 15 is probably the woman speaking, or perhaps even the women. They say, or she says, catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom. The outdoors is beautiful and vibrant, but it's also dangerous. And our vineyards, these women say, our vineyards are in bloom. These are women in their sexual maturity. And if you men want us to come out to you, then first catch the little foxes that ruin the vineyards. Now, we're not directly told how this request is resolved, but again, this vignette finishes with a climax. Verse 16. My lover is mine, and I am his. He browses among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, turn, my lover, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the rugged hills. So we're given these two images here. Two images are particularly in these verses. First, there's an image of devoted love, devotion. My lover is mine and I am his. Exclusive, without interruption, without interference. And secondly, there's a picture of lovemaking. And again, it draws on this outdoor imagery. She is the lily and he browses among the lilies. And as a gazelle, he had leapt over the mountains to rush to her. And now he's like a gazelle on a different pair of hills. In verse 17, an unmistakable allusion to her breasts. See, this poem is tasteful and beautiful in its treatment of sex. But it is not hesitant or embarrassed. It is unashamedly bold. It celebrates sexual love. Many of the individual acts culminate in the couple's lovemaking. Now, all I've been doing is reading these chapters with you, thinking about these verses together. Is this what you expect to find in the Bible? Is this what our world expects to find in the Bible? Is this what we expect God to say about the relationships between men and women? Let me offer some conclusions. What would Christianity look like if we heeded the message of the Song of Songs? First, we would celebrate the goodness of creation, including the goodness of sexual love. All of this outdoor imagery, trees, flowers, fruit, abundance, what does it remind us of? It reminds us of where the Bible started, with the creation of one man and one woman, and God placing them in a garden full of fruit, told to eat and enjoy, and given to one another, singing to one another, delighting in one another. This is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. A garden in which the husband and his wife were naked and unashamed. To be true Christianity, to be attractive Christianity, to be compelling Christianity, we need to celebrate the goodness of creation, and that includes the goodness of sexual love. Secondly, not only do we need to celebrate it, but we need to praise the goodness of creation, including beauty, wherever it's found. You know, we can be very restrained in our praise. I think it's partly because we're Australians, and Australians, we tend not to praise people. We prefer to cut down tall poppies than to compliment anyone. And as Christians, I wonder whether we can be even more reserved than most in our praise. Perhaps it's because we fear idolatry, we don't want to be kind of too absorbed by creation's beauty that we lose sight of God. Or perhaps we fear pride, we don't want to inflate people's egos. But when you look at the Bible is full of praise. Praise for goodness wherever it's found. Praise for beauty in creation wherever it's found. Praise for goodness in people. Just think, if you're familiar with the Bible, the Apostle Paul writes many letters in the New Testament. Many of them start with a prayer, and most of those prayers begin with thanksgiving and praise to God for goodness that he sees in God's people. Their love, their faith, their hope. Biblical Christianity confesses sin, but biblical Christianity also praises goodness and beauty. Now, physical beauty is not the only kind, nor is it the most important kind. But as Christians, we need to be comfortable with it and we need to praise it. No husband can ever praise his wife too much, nor can a wife praise her husband too much. Praise for one another's beauty should flow from us freely. Third observation, third comment in conclusion. We see in these chapters that there are many things that spoil the goodness of sexual love. There are men who acquire women as prizes or control them as they would their property. There are women who compare themselves and demand conformity to a particular standard of beauty. There's the premature awakening of sexual love before its proper time. And there are foxes that ruin the vineyards. See, the Song of Songs is, the Bible is not naive about love. It recognises that there is a dark side to sex, to love gone wrong. And I'll have much more to say about that next week. But for now, I want to close on this note. Even in a broken world, as Song of Songs shows us, even in a world among fallen people, with King Solomon and foxes, and even in that world, beauty and goodness are celebrated. So friends, how much more ought beauty and goodness be celebrated among the redeemed people of God? How much more among the first fruits of a new creation? Let's pray. Father, everything you have made is good. Nothing is to be rejected, but everything received with thanksgiving. We thank you, Father, for all your good gifts of creation. And today we thank you that you have made us as men and women. We thank you for the gift of relationships. We thank you for the gift of love and the gift of marriage and of sex. Father, we pray that as Christians you would help us to delight in your good gifts and to treat them with reverence and to treat them appropriately. Father, many people have been hurt by sex. Many people are confused. Many people look on Christians with scorn. Lord, we pray that in this day you would help us to return to your word and see the positive side of love and sex that you teach us here. Help us to proclaim it. Help us to praise it. Help us to live it. In Jesus' name, amen.